Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome back to our continuing series on Dharma, presented by Professor G. Venkatraman. Today, we bring you Professor's seventh talk in this series, and now over to Professor Venkatraman.
Loving Sairam, and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. This is my seventh talk in the current Dharma series. The second on chapter 2, titled Draupadi's Courage. In my last talk, I briefly narrated how, after being dragged from her private chamber to the assembly, Draupadi was shockingly humiliated. Luckily, she was saved, literally in the nick of time, by a paranormal intervention of what I call cosmic justice. The rest of my earlier talk was all about this cosmic justice and its divine connection. In today's talk, I wish to discuss two other points touched upon by Das in his chapter 2. These two topics being, one, two specific questions raised by Draupadi, and two, whether Dharma implies a discipline of ordered existence. Okay, let me go to point one. When Draupadi was summoned to appear in the assembly after Yudhishthira lost the dice game, she raised two questions. Her first question, whom did you lose first, yourself or me, was supposed to have been conveyed by Duryodhana's messenger to Yudhishthira, even as Draupadi stubbornly refused to respond to Duryodhana's summons. Her second question was more a lament than a question. Utterly alone in the assembly, and with all the elders and her husbands remaining aloof, Draupadi asked rhetorically, what is left of the Dharma of Kings? Let me begin with Draupadi's initial question. Going back to the moment when Duryodhana's messenger enters Draupadi's private chamber and tells her, after briefly mentioning that Yudhishthira had lost her to Duryodhana, that she must appear in the assembly, Draupadi reacts by telling the messenger that she will not come to the assembly. Instead, she asks the messenger to go back and ask her husband, whom did you lose first, yourself or me? That is what I just now referred to as Draupadi's first question. It so happened that when the messenger went back to the assembly and spoke to Yudhishthira, he told that Draupadi wants an answer to the question, as the owner of whom did you lose us? In other words, knowingly or otherwise, the messenger changed the question, and in the form it was actually put to Yudhishthira, it raised a very basic issue, which is, can any human being own another human being? Does Dharma allow for any room for slavery? Before I deal with these ticklish issues, I would like to draw attention to a definition of Dharma as offered by Sage Aurobindo. In his book titled Essays on the Gita, Aurobindo describes Dharma as follows, and I quote, Dharma is a word which has an ethical and a practical, a natural and philosophical, and a religious and spiritual significance, and it may be used in any of these senses exclusive of the others, that is to say in a purely ethical, a purely philosophical, or purely religious manner. Ethically, it means the law of righteousness, the moral rule of conduct, or in a still more outward and practical significance, social and political justice, or simply the observance of the social law. End of quote. Aurobindo then also goes on to say, significantly I might add, quote, if used in this latter sense, we shall have to understand that when unrighteousness, injustice and oppression prevail, the avatar descends to deliver the good and destroy the wicked. What Aurobindo is telling us is that there are three levels at which Dharma can be discussed, they being A, an ethical and practical level, B, a philosophical level, and C, a religious and spiritual level. In other words, dharma straddles all the three levels mentioned above, although in particular context, the discussion might be confined to just one level. Please bear this in mind as I proceed further. I now turn to the issue, does dharma allow room for slavery? If you recall, this is what Draupadi's first question got twisted into on account of the way the messengers changed the words while trying to convey Draupadi's actual question to Yudhishthira. Modern scholars would immediately raise the question, did slavery exist in ancient India? I don't know. Maybe it did and was permitted by man-made law, or maybe it did not. Be that as it may, Das says, and I quote here, Draupadi's question suggests that she did not think that what is lawful is necessarily right. Dharma must therefore mean something other than what is customary, end of quote. I entirely agree with Das. And to bolster my view, I turn to Aurobindo once again, who, you would recall, reminds us that dharma must be considered at many levels. What he does not say, but nevertheless implies, is that spirituality has to be the true basis for and also the foundation of dharma. Always. No exception. Swami says the same, stressing that there is simply no room for seeking any exemption from the applicability of dharma. Dharma applies to all, from a king to a pauper, at all times and in all situations. As simple as that. Well, a classic case of how man can twist non-negotiable moral laws is provided by what happened in America following the revolution and the defeat of the British. The colonies in America then declared themselves to be free by issuing the famous Declaration of Independence, which begins with the following high-sounding words, and I quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." End of quote. Well, all men are supposed to be created according to the founding fathers, but interestingly, many of them owned slaves. Would you believe that? And the slave owners included George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and Thomas Jefferson. While the discrimination against Africans is understandable in the sense that they were bought as property in Africa and then imported just as one imports animals and commodities, what is surprising is that these white men denied the vote to even white women, and this denial lasted until 1920, 150 or so years after independence. In other words, in the eyes of the founding father, only all white men were equal. That is odd. Anyway, that's the way the world goes. Okay, so slavery existed in America despite pompous declarations by the founding fathers that all men are created equal. And this slavery existed till it was formally abolished in 1865. What I am trying to say is that when clear-cut moral issues were involved, taking shelter under so-called legal provisions is immoral and totally unacceptable. In other words, issues related to morality can be judged only at the level of the conscience, which advises as to which actions conform to dharma and which do not. I now wish to cite an explicit example to illustrate how man-made laws may be inadequate, allowing people to exploit legal loopholes to engage in actions that do not conform to dharma, i.e. are clearly adharmic. My example is that of a well-known Indian politician who is charged with making a huge sum of money via illegal transactions involving the sale of government property. It was, of course, a criminal case, and the matter went all the way up to the Indian Supreme Court. The politician concerned had exploited the legal loophole so adroitly that the court was forced to dismiss the charges. However, while delivering the judgment, the court also emphatically declared that while it could not find the defendant guilty under any provision of law, The person concerned was nevertheless answerable to the individual's conscience. It is not often that a court is left helpless and leaves the defendant to answer to a higher power. But that has happened. And what does it show? It shows, as Gandhi humbly said, that there is a moral law governing the universe to which all must bow. And my point is that the law Gandhi was referring to is nothing but the law of Dharma. Before I proceed further, maybe I should mention that thus far I have been discussing Draupadi's first question, whom did you lose first, yourself or me, which was changed by Duryodhana's messenger into, as the owner of whom did you lose us, which essentially converted Draupadi's original question into an issue of slavery. And the point I have tried to make thus far is that if slavery is the issue, there is no sanction for it in Dharma. I hope I have made that clear. Let me now turn to Draupadi's general lament. What is left of the Dharma of kings? If you recall, she made this agonizing comment shortly before Dhritarashtra set Draupadi and the Pandavas free, restoring back to them all that had been stolen from Yudhishthira by trickery. I don't know what you think, but my own feeling is that when Draupadi cried out in anguish using the words quoted above, what is left of Dharma of kings, she was probably having two kings in mind, namely her own husband Yudhishthira and King Dhritarashtra. At least that is my take, and I shall proceed along those lines. To appreciate why two kings have been brought in, recall first that prior to the dice game, the kingdom of the Kurus had been partitioned into two parts, one part going to the Pandavas, since Pandu, whose sons they were, was deceased, while the other half went to Dhritarashtra, whose sons were the 100 Kaurava brothers, headed by Duryodhana. Okay, there were two kings in the assembly, one being Yudhishthira, and other being his uncle Dhritarashtra. Although prima facie, Draupadi's plight was largely the fault of her husband Yudhishthira, who was also a king, Draupadi's comment lays equal blame on Dhritarashtra also. How is that? Let us examine. India in earlier times was a tapestry of small kingdoms, each ruled by a king. Back then, kings were expected to be ideal rulers, upholding justice and fair play. The reason for such high expectation was that when rulers set high moral standards, people tended to follow them. Thus it is that we have the ancient saying, Yatha Raja, Tatha Praja, meaning, as is the king, so are his subjects. If keeping this in mind we examine Yudhishthira, he fails on several counts. Firstly, the game was supposed to be a part of the Rajasya Yajna performed by him and ought to have been played in his palace. Instead, Yudhishthira allowed himself to be persuaded to accept Dhritarashtra's court as the venue. That is mistake number one. Next, right at the beginning, Yudhishthira emphatically stipulated to Shakuni that there must be no cheating. And yet, there was Shakuni openly cheating from the very first throw of the dice. Yudhishthira was well aware of what was going on. And yet, not once did Yudhishthira call out Shakuni and ask him to stop the game forthwith. Furthermore, while a king may offer as bet his personal items, like jewelry and so on, he had absolutely no business whatsoever to wager his kingdom. A man may rule over a kingdom, but that did not mean that the kingdom was his personal property. A just ruler of those days always ruled over his kingdom for and on behalf of God. In other words, the ruler was merely a trustee of God, looking after a certain territory, which of course meant he should govern wisely and justly. According to this yardstick, Yudhishthira failed miserably by wagering not only the kingdom he ruled over, but also his siblings and his wife, none of whom he owned. Some people may not buy this idea of trusteeship. I would like to draw the attention of such skeptics to what late Kasturi wrote about a small ritual that was performed when he was just a few days old. Kasturi was born in the state of Kerala, where, for ages, the tradition has been that within a week or so after a child is born, the child is taken to a temple and placed before the presiding deity there, whoever it is, Krishna, Rama, Shiva or whatever. Following this, the parents then offer a fervent prayer, which in effect says the following: Lord, this child is really yours, and by your grace, this child has come to us. Please bless us, so that we may bring up this child of yours in the manner that you would like of us. Reverentially accepting this baby as your prasadam or divine blessing, we now seek your permission to take it back to our home, to be its caretaker, and raise it truly as a child of God. Kasturi describes in detail how as a baby he went through this routine. I have been a personal witness to this tradition as late as 1970. Whether this practice exists today, I do not know. All I can say is that I would not be surprised if, along with many other wonderful Indian traditions, the noble idea of trusteeship has also been swept away by the tsunami called globalization. Let me now turn to Dhritarashtra, who was the second king present in the assembly. In fact, it was in his palace where the dice game took place, which made him the host. These days, the expectation in any country where the rule of law prevails, as is the case in most countries, is that the governmental system would protect all its citizens from being harmed by rogue elements and evil-minded people. Furthermore, the same law and order system is expected to offer similar protection to tourists also. For verily, the tourists are guests of the country they are visiting. Our history tells us that in the days of yore, good rulers always ensured protection of the type I have just described. Seen in that light, Dhritarashtra seems to have been an utter failure. True, he was blind, but he always had someone next to him. Most often it was Vidura, and this someone next to him always provided a running commentary on what was happening. During the dice game, the blind king must surely have known that Shakuni was up to no good. In fact, says author Das, that while Vidura was trying to get Dhritarashtra to stop the game, the hypocritical king was so happy seeing his son winning that he ignored his counselor. It did not stop there. Dhritarashtra continued to remain silent when his son Dushyasana was publicly humiliating Draupadi. It was only after the divine intervention and Vidura's dire warning that there would be a heavy price to pay for all this that the blind king wakes up and tries to salvage the situation by telling Draupadi to ask for boons. I described all that last time. Before leaving this topic of kings and how they were expected to rule justly, there is the story of a just ruler, which in earlier times was often narrated in Tamil Nadu, where I hail from. I wish to share that story with you, and it goes as follows. This king, famous for his insistence on justice and fair play, got installed near the palace gates a huge bell, which could be rung by anyone who felt aggrieved that justice had been denied and wanted fair play. Apparently, the king took his responsibility very seriously and was hailed for being just and very fair. One day, when the king heard the bell ringing, he asked, as usual, his minister to go out and find out who was ringing the bell and why. The minister went out, and when he returned after a little while, he said, "O king, something strange is happening. A cow has, using its mouth, gripped the rope attached to the bell and is ringing it." The king was surprised and ordered his minister to go out again and find out whether the cow was just amusing itself or if there was some other reason behind its action. The minister went out once more, and this time when he came back, he looked ashen and as if in shock. Alarmed, the king asked, "You look pale and deeply upset. Tell me, what exactly is the matter?" The minister then explained why the cow was ringing the bell. A few hours earlier, the king's son, that is to say the crown prince, had gone for a ride on his horse. He was going so fast and so rashly that his horse ran over a newborn calf, killing it in the process. And now the mother cow was ringing the bell, seeking justice. The king then asked the minister, "How is justice rendered in such a case?" The minister grimly replied that since the prince had killed a baby, the law required for the prince to pay with his life. In other words, the prince had to be put to death. That was the law of the land. The king was stunned, naturally, but stoically he ordered the execution of the crown prince. This may be just a story, but the point is that India has had a long history when the law of the land was pegged to dharma, even if it was inconvenient at times. It's time for me to pause and offer a brief recall of what I have said thus far. I have dealt with the two questions posed by Draupadi, and furthermore the issue of whether slavery is moral or immoral. Still to be discussed is whether dharma has any connection with a discipline of ordered existence that the celebrated American commentator Walter Lippmann referred to. Before I come to that, I wish to draw attention to a curious fact that is hardly ever mentioned, and that has to do with people, even those of integrity, remaining silent when values and basic moral principles are being openly flouted. Consider, for instance, what was happening in the assembly hall long before Yudhishthira wagered Draupadi and lost her. What I am referring to is the fact that right from the word go, Shakuni was cheating left and right, even as Yudhishthira was rapidly losing his positions one after another. That Shakuni was blatantly cheating must have been obvious to everyone present, and yet not a single person protested, starting from the wise elder Bhishma. It was Vidura alone who tried to nudge Dhritarashtra to stop the game, but he failed to get any traction. What is surprising is that even the Pandavas remained silent while everything was stolen right under their nose. Maybe they remained silent out of respect to their elder brother, whom they revered very much. But what about Bhishma, Dronacharya and Kripacharya? They all knew the scriptures, they all were respected elders, and they knew what was right and what was wrong. How come they abdicated their moral obligations and chose to remain totally silent? I am raising this point because there is a lesson in all this for today's world. If we look around carefully, we can find any number of examples of moral atrocities in the shape of cruel and ruthless exploitation of women and children, calculated cheating by big companies operating in the service sector, taking gullible customers for a ride, and so on. Many know about such happenings, but few bother to comment and draw attention to such egregious violations of dharma. The question thus becomes, if people know that things are happening that are not good and are bound to have undesirable consequences later, then why don't they speak out strongly and prevent the looming disaster? That is a critical question which needs a clear answer. However, presently I cannot dive deep into that issue and have to be content with pointing out the basic problem. Later, of course, we shall confront that question directly and seek answers. For now, let me just say that these are days when there is an abundance of people of sharp intellect. The analytical abilities of such people are tremendous, and their worldly credentials are impeccable. At the same time, when it comes to problems involving human beings, these people achieve precious little. That is because cold and precise logic is of little use where man-made problems are concerned. As a result, utter failure is often the end result. A classic example of this is provided by the late Robert McNamara, who, after a dazzling career at the Ford Motor Company, was hired by President Kennedy to be his defense secretary. The Vietnam War had just broken out, and McNamara applied his powerful mind to work out various strategies to achieve a clear and decisive victory for the Americans. Try as he might, he failed to achieve his goal. Meanwhile, American soldiers were dying in thousands. The final count was around 45,000, I believe. While the country sharply asked, why should our young men die in a faraway country with which we have very little connection? Eventually, America withdrew from the Vietnam War, while McNamara spent the rest of his life rueing his mistake. Sadly, realization of his fatal flaw came too late for him, and when he died, the obituaries were sharp and unforgiving. Though widely ignored, what McNamara said late in his life is worth paying attention to. He said roughly, if only I had put myself in the shoes of those Vietnamese, I might have handled the entire situation differently. The Vietnam experience changed McNamara completely. Coming to the conclusion that war is futile, McNamara worked hard in later years to curtail nuclear proliferation. Much more can and perhaps ought to be said on this business of war, but this is not the occasion for that. Nevertheless, I would make one observation and pose one question. My observation is that if we look at recent history in many parts of the world, there is little evidence that the lesson taught by the Vietnam War has been absorbed and put to use, which is sad to say the least. Coming to my question, if war is futile as McNamara painfully discovered, though late in the day, how come such a super smart man failed to see the same truth earlier when he could have done something positive? I think this question should not be difficult to answer if you have been following me in this series. But here is a more difficult question. If war is futile, then why did Krishna urge Arjuna to fight? I am sure you would appreciate that the second question is far more subtle. Please come back with your answers, for we are keen to know how you view these issues. It's time to end, but that I cannot do unless I deal with the question, does dharma imply a discipline of ordered existence? You may recall I mentioned this right at the beginning of my talk. Towards the end of his chapter on Draupadi, Gurcharan Das quotes the distinguished American journalist, writer and political commentator Walter Lippmann, who lived from 1889 to 1974. In a speech delivered in 1941, Lippmann, after saying that one cannot be happy by merely satisfying one's desires, declares that happiness comes by upholding a balance, by living according to a system of beliefs that restrains one's desires and gives coherence. Lippmann then goes on to say, and I quote, above all the other necessities of human nature, love, pleasure, fame, even life itself, what a man needs most is the conviction that he is contained within the discipline of an ordered existence. End of quote. Okay, the question now before us is, does dharma have any connection at all with Walter Lippmann said? My response is as follows. First, Lippmann is clear that happiness does not come from the mere gratification of one's desires. That is directly in accordance with, in tune with what Swami has also told us. Lippmann goes on to say, one must live by a system of belief that demands placing a restraint on individual desires. That is what Swami also told us. Place a ceiling on your desires. And then Lippmann finally says, one must seek a certain balance which restrains the individual to hold personal desire within the discipline of an ordered existence. Now that's a bit of a long sentence. You may not be able to grasp what he says. But I think we can understand what he said by tying it up with what Swami told us. Actually, Swami has said quite a lot, and we sure need to deal with all that later. For now, the essential point of what Swami said is that the individual and society are an integral part of one whole, and they just cannot be fragmented as though they were separated. And in this tightly coupled system which binds the individual and the society, the individual is the micro while the society is the macro. Society would be in an excellent state of health when every single individual works for the larger good of society, while the latter, I'll read that again. Society would be in an excellent state of health when every single individual works for the larger good of society, even as the latter, namely society, reciprocates by taking good care of the individual. Something like all for one and one for all. Such a situation would represent perfect dharmic harmony, which however is seldom possible. More practical and pertinent is the idea of balance mentioned by Lippmann. To appreciate what this means, we have to visualize a physical balance that is fairly sensitive. Say one pan is set for dharma and the other pan is set for adharma. Now, if the dharmic index of society and the adharmic index of society are equal to each other, two pans will be in balance. Clearly, the minimum requirement for stability is for society to have as much dharma as there is adharma. If there is more of dharma, so much the better. But if there is less of dharma, then we are in trouble. No wonder Swami emphatically declared that without individual character, there cannot be any national character. That says a lot, does it not? To sum up, Walter Lippmann, I would say, intuitively grasped not only the importance of curbing personal desires, but also the essence of the correct relationship between the individual and society. And that is something Swami has also told us again and again. Now, given the fact that America is usually regarded as a symbol of materialism, Walter Lippmann's thoughts are not only sobering, but also call attention to America's rich crop of top-class thinkers and philosophers who have articulated high values. Well, that's all I have for you this week. This talk has been a bit shorter than usual, but even so, I hope it has offered enough for you to think about. Offering this talk at the lotus feet of our beloved Swami, I take your leave. God bless everyone. And Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, that brings to an end talk number 7 in the current series on Dharma presented by Professor Jeevankatraman. Dear listener, your questions and feedback are available to us. You may write to listener@radiosai.org. And if you don't mind, kindly draw the attention of people who have missed this program to listen to it by downloading the podcast, which is available on our website www.radiosai.org. Thank you and Sai Ram.